saying, "I speak in a great university which represents the flower of the highest intellectual development. I pay all homage to intellect and to elaborate and specialized training of the intellect. And yet I know I shall have the assent of all of you present when I add that more important still are the commonplace, everyday qualities and virtues." And yet, when Roosevelt says, "The closet philosopher, the refined and cultured individual who from his library tells how men ought to be governed under ideal conditions, is of no use in actual governmental work," I think of Condorcet, who spent his time in the library doing just that, and who contributed more to the French state than most of the time's more practical men. And when Roosevelt sneers at the cold and timid souls who sit on the sidelines and second-guess the warriors, I come back to Abraham Wald, who, as far as I know, went his whole life without lifting a weapon in anger, but who nonetheless played a serious part in the American war effort, precisely by counseling the doers of deeds how to do them better. He was unsweaty, undusty, and unbloody, but he was right. He was a critic who counted. For this is action. Against Roosevelt, I place John Ashbery, whose poem Soonest Mended is the greatest summation I know of the way uncertainty and revelation can mingle without dissolving together in the human mind. It's a more complex and accurate portrait of life's enterprise than Roosevelt's hard-charging man's man, sore and broken but never doubting his direction. Ashbery's sad comic vision of citizenship might almost be a reply to Roosevelt's citizenship in a republic. The poem concludes, "And you see, both of us were right. Though nothing has somehow come to nothing, the avatars of our conforming to the rules and living around the home have made, well, in a sense, good citizens of us. Brushing the teeth and all that, and learning to accept the charity of the hard moments as they are doled out. For this is action, this not being sure, this careless preparing, sowing the seeds crooked in the furrow, making ready to forget and always coming back to the mooring of starting out that day so long ago. For this is action, this not being sure." It is a sentence I often repeat to myself like a mantra. Theodore Roosevelt would surely have denied that not being sure was a kind of action. He would have called it cowardly fence-sitting. The House Martins, the greatest Marxist pop band ever to pick up guitars, took Roosevelt's side in their 1986 song, Sitting on a Fence, a withering portrait of a wishy-washy political moderate. The song goes, "Sitting on a fence is a man who swings from pole to pole. Sitting on a fence is a man who sees both sides of both sides. But the real problem with this man is he says he can't when he can." But Roosevelt and the House Martins are wrong, and Ashbery is right. For him, not being sure is the move of a strong person, not a weakling. It is, elsewhere in the poem, a kind of fence-sitting raised to the level of an aesthetic ideal. And math is part of it. People usually think of mathematics as the realm of certainty and absolute truth. In some ways, that's right. We traffic in necessary facts. 2 + 3 = 5 and all that. But mathematics is also a means by which we can reason about the uncertain, taming, if not altogether domesticating it. It's been that way since the time of Pascal, who started by helping gamblers understand the whims of chance and ended up figuring the betting odds on the most cosmic uncertainty of all. Math gives us a way of being unsure in a principled way. Not just throwing up our hands and saying, huh, but rather making a firm assertion, I'm not sure, this is why I'm not sure, and this is roughly how not sure I am. Or even more, I'm unsure, and you should be too. A man who swings from pole to pole. The paladin of principled uncertainty in our time is Nate Silver, the online poker player turned baseball statistics maven turned political analyst, whose New York Times columns about the 2012 presidential election drew more public attention to the methods of probability theory than they have ever before enjoyed. I think of Silver as a kind of Kurt Cobain of probability. Both were devoted to cultural practices that had previously been confined to a small, inward-looking cadre of true believers. For Silver, quantitative forecasting of sports and politics, for Cobain, punk rock. And both proved that if you carry their practice out in public with an approachable style but without compromising the source material, you could make it massively popular. What made Silver so good? In large part, it's that he was willing to talk about uncertainty, willing to treat uncertainty not as a sign of weakness, but as a real thing in the world, a thing that can be studied with scientific rigor and employed to good effect. If it's September 2012 and you ask a bunch of political pundits, who's going to be elected president in November? A bunch of them are going to say Obama is, and a somewhat smaller bunch are going to say Romney is, and the point is that all of those people are wrong because the right answer is the kind of answer that Silver, almost alone in the broad-reach media, was willing to give. Either one might win, but Obama is substantially more likely to win. Traditional political types greeted this response with the same disrespect I got from my tuberculosis boss. They wanted an answer. They didn't understand that Silver was giving them one. Josh Jordan in the National Review wrote, on September 30th, leading into the debates, Silver gave Obama an 85% chance and predicted an electoral college count of 320 to 218. Today, the margins have narrowed. But Silver still gives Obama a 67% chance and an electoral college lead of 288 to 250, which has led many to wonder if he has observed the same movement to Romney over the past 3 weeks as everyone else has. Had Silver noticed the movement to Romney? Clearly, yes. He gave Romney a 15% chance of winning at the end of September and a 33% chance on October 22nd, more than twice as much. But Jordan didn't notice that Silver had noticed, because Silver was still estimating, correctly, that Obama had a better chance of winning than Romney did. For traditional political reporters like Jordan, that meant his answer hadn't changed. Or take Dylan Byers in Politico, who wrote, so should Mitt Romney win on November 6th, it's difficult to see how people can continue to put faith in the predictions of someone who has never given that candidate anything higher than a 41% chance of winning way back on June 2nd, and 1 week from the election gives him a 1 in 4 chance, even as the polls have him almost neck and neck with the incumbent. For all the confidence Silver puts in his predictions, he often gives the impression of hedging. If you care at all about math, this is the kind of thing that makes you want to stab yourself in the hand with a fork. What Silver offers isn't hedging, it's honesty. When the weather report says there's a 40% chance of rain, and it rains, do you lose faith in its predictions? No, you recognize that the weather is inherently uncertain, and that a definitive statement of whether it will or won't rain tomorrow is usually the wrong thing to offer. Of course, Obama did win in the end, and with a comfortable margin, leaving Silver's critics looking a little foolish. The irony is that if the critics had wanted to catch Silver in a mistaken prediction, they missed a great chance. They could have asked him, how many states are you going to get wrong? As far as I know, nobody ever asked Silver this question, but it's easy to figure out how he would have answered it. On October 26th, Silver estimated that Obama had a 69% chance of winning New Hampshire. If you forced him to predict then and there, he'd call it for Obama. So you could say that Silver estimated his chance of being wrong about New Hampshire to be 0.31. Put in other words, the expected number of wrong answers he would give about New Hampshire was 0.31. Remember, the expected value isn't the value you expect, but rather a probabilistic compromise among the possible outcomes. In this case, he's either going to give zero wrong answers about New Hampshire, an outcome with probability 0.69, or one, an outcome with probability 0.31, which gives an expected value of 0.69 times 0 plus 0.31 times 1, or 0.31, via the method we set up in Chapter 11. Silver was more certain about North Carolina, giving Obama only a 19% chance of winning. But that still means he estimated a 19% probability that his Romney call would end up wrong. That is, he gave himself another 0.19 expected wrong answers. Since expected value is additive, Silver's best guess at the number of competitive states he'd pick wrong is just the sum of the contributions of all these states, which comes to 2.83. In other words, he'd probably have said, if anyone had asked him, on average, I'm likely to get about 3 states wrong. Actually, he got all 50 right. Even the most seasoned political pundit might have had trouble pulling off an attack on Silver for being more accurate than he said he would be. The twistiness this incites in the mind is healthy. Follow it. When you reason correctly, as Silver does, you find that you always think you're right, but you don't think you're always right. As the philosopher W.O.V. Quine put it, to believe something is to believe that it is true. Therefore, a reasonable person believes each of his beliefs to be true, yet experience has taught him to expect that some of his beliefs, he knows not which, will turn out to be false. A reasonable person believes, in short, that each of his beliefs is true, and that some of them are false. Formally, this is very similar to the apparent contradictions in American public opinion we unraveled in Chapter 17. The American people think each government program is worthy of continued funding, but that doesn't mean they think all government programs are worthy of continued funding. Silver bypassed the sclerotic conventions of political reporting and told the public a truer story. Instead of saying who was going to win or who had the momentum, he reported what he thought the chances were. Instead of saying how many electoral votes Obama was going to win, he presented a probability distribution. Say, Obama had a 67% chance of getting the 270 electoral votes he needed for re-election, a 44% chance of breaking 300, a 21% chance of getting to 330, and so on. Silver was being uncertain, rigorously uncertain, in public, and the public ate it up. I wouldn't have thought it was possible. This is action, this not being sure. Against precision. One criticism of Silver, to which I'm somewhat sympathetic, is that it's misleading to make statements like, Obama has a 73.1% chance of winning as of today. The decimal suggests a precision of measurement that's probably not there. You don't want to say that something meaningful has happened if his model gives 73.1% one day and 73.0% the next. This is a criticism of Silver's presentation, not his actual program, but it carried a lot of weight with political writers who felt readers were being bullied into acceptance by an impressively precise-looking number. There's such a thing as being too precise. The models we use to score standardized tests could give SAT scores to several decimal places if we let them, but we shouldn't. Students are anxious enough as it is without having to worry about their classmate nosing ahead of them by a hundredth of a point. The fetish of perfect precision affects elections not just in the fevered poll-watching period, but after the election takes place. The Florida 2000 election, remember, rode on a difference of a few hundred votes between George W. Bush and Al Gore, a hundredth of a percent of the total votes cast. It was of critical importance, by our law and custom, to determine which candidate it was who could claim a few hundred more ballots than the other. But as a way of thinking about who Floridians wanted to be president, this is absurd. The imprecision caused by ballots spoiled, ballots lost, ballots miscounted is much greater than the tiny difference in the final count. We don't know who got more votes in Florida. The difference between judges and mathematicians is that judges have to find a way to pretend we know, while mathematicians are free to tell the truth. The journalist Charles Seif included in his book Proofiness a very funny and mildly depressing chronicle of the similarly close contest between Democrat Al Franken and Republican Norm Coleman to represent Minnesota in the U.S. Senate. It would be great to say that Franken took office because a cold analytical procedure showed exactly 312 more Minnesotans wanted to see him seated in the chamber. In reality, though, that number reflects the result of an extended legal tussle over questions like whether a ballot with a mark for Franken and a write-in for lizard people was legally cast. Once you get down to this kind of issue, the question of who really got more votes doesn't even make sense. The signal is lost in the noise. And I tend to side with Seif, who argues that elections this close should be decided by coin flip. Of course, if you wanted to set this up correctly, you'd have to modify the coin flip to give a greater chance of winning to the candidate who appears to be slightly ahead, etc., etc. Some will balk at the idea of choosing our leaders by chance. But that's actually the coin flip's most important benefit. Close elections are already determined by chance. Bad weather in the big city, a busted voting machine in an outlying town, a poorly designed ballot leading elderly Jews to vote for Pat Buchanan. Any of these chance events can make the difference when the electorate is stuck at 50-50. Choosing by coin flip helps keep us from pretending that the people have spoken for the winning candidate in a closely divided race. Sometimes the people speak and they say, I don't know. You might think I'd be really into decimal places. The conjoined twin of the stereotype that mathematicians are always certain is the stereotype that we are always precise, determined to compute everything to as many decimal places as possible. It isn't so. We want to compute everything to as many decimal places as necessary. There's a young man in China named Liu Chao who learned and recited 67,890 digits of pi. That's an impressive feat of memory. But is it interesting? No, because the digits of pi are not interesting. As far as anyone knows, they're as good as random. Pi itself is interesting, to be sure, but pi is not its digits. It is merely specified by its digits, in the same way the Eiffel Tower is specified by the longitude and latitude 48.8586 degrees north, 2.2942 degrees east. Add as many decimal places to those numbers as you want, and they still won't tell you what makes the Eiffel Tower the Eiffel Tower. Precision isn't just about digits. Benjamin Franklin wrote cuttingly of a member of his Philadelphia set, Thomas Godfrey, "He knew little out of his way and was not a pleasing companion, as, like most great mathematicians I have met with, he expected universal precision in everything said, or was forever denying or distinguishing upon trifles, to the disturbance of all conversation." This stings because it's only partially unfair. Mathematicians can be persnickety about logical niceties. We're the kind of people who think it's funny when asked, "Do you want super salad with that?" to reply, "Yes." That does not compute. And yet, even mathematicians don't, except when cracking wise, try to make themselves beings of pure logic. It can be dangerous to do so. For example, if you're a purely deductive thinker, once you believe two contradictory facts, you are logically obliged to believe that every statement is false. Here's how that goes. Suppose I believe both that Paris is the capital of France and that it's not. This seems to have nothing to do with whether the Portland Trailblazers were NBA champions in 1982. But now watch this trick. Is it the case that Paris is the capital of France and the Trailblazers won the NBA championship? It is not, because I know that Paris is not the capital of France. If it's not true that Paris is the capital of France and the Trailblazers were the champs, then either Paris isn't the capital of France or the Trailblazers weren't NBA champs. But I know that Paris is the capital of France, which rules out the first possibility. So, the Trailblazers did not win the 1982 NBA championship. It is not hard to check that an argument of exactly the same form, but standing on its head, proves that every statement is also true. This sounds weird, but as a logical deduction, it's irrefutable. Drop one tiny contradiction anywhere into a formal system, and the whole thing goes to hell. Philosophers of a mathematical bent call this brittleness in formal logic ex falso quod libet, or among friends, the principle of explosion. Remember what I said about how much math people love violent terminology? Ex falso quod libet is how Captain James T. Kirk used to disable dictatorial AIs. Feed them a paradox and their reasoning modules frazzle and halt. That, they plaintively remark just before the power light goes out, does not compute. Bertrand Russell did to Gottlob Frege's set theory what Kirk did to uppity robots. His one sneaky paradox brought the whole edifice down. But Kirk's trick doesn't work on human beings. We don't reason this way, not even those of us who do math for a living. We are tolerant of contradiction, to a point. As F. Scott Fitzgerald said, "The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function." Mathematicians use this ability as a basic tool of thought. It's essential for the reductio ad absurdum, which requires you to hold in your mind a proposition you believe to be false and reason as if you think it's true. Suppose the square root of 2 is a rational number, even though I'm trying to prove it's not. It is lucid dreaming of a very systematic kind, and we can do it without short-circuiting ourselves. In fact, it's a common piece of folk advice. I know I heard it from my PhD advisor, and presumably he from his, etc., that when you're working hard on a theorem, you should try to prove it by day and disprove it by night. The precise frequency of the toggle isn't critical. It's said of the topologist R.H. Bing that his habit was to split each month between 2 weeks trying to prove the Poincaré conjecture and 2 weeks trying to find a counterexample. Why work at such cross purposes? There are two good reasons. The first is that you might, after all, be wrong. If the statement you think is true is really false, all your effort to prove it is doomed to be useless. Disproving by night is a kind of hedge against that gigantic waste. But there's a deeper reason. If something is true and you try to disprove it, you will fail. We're trained to think of failure as bad, but it's not all bad. You can learn from failure. You try to disprove the statement one way, and you hit a wall. You try another way, and you hit another wall. Each night you try, each night you fail, each night a new wall, and if you're lucky, those walls start to come together into a structure, and that structure is the structure of the proof of the theorem. For if you have really understood what's keeping you from disproving the theorem, you very likely understand, in a way inaccessible to you before, why the theorem is true. This is what happened to Boyer, who bucked his father's well-meaning advice and tried, like so many before him, to prove that the parallel postulate followed from Euclid's other axioms. Like all the others, he failed. But unlike the others, he was able to understand the shape of his failure. What was blocking all his attempts to prove that there was no geometry without the parallel postulate was the existence of just such a geometry. And with each failed attempt, he learned more about the features of the thing he didn't think existed, getting to know it more and more intimately until the moment when he realized it was really there. Proving by day and disproving by night is not just for mathematics. I find it's a good habit to put pressure on all your beliefs, social, political, scientific, and philosophical. Believe whatever you believe by day, but at night, argue against the propositions you hold most dear. Don't cheat. To the greatest extent possible, you have to think as though you believe what you don't believe. And if you can't talk yourself out of your existing beliefs, you'll know a lot more about why you believe what you believe. You'll have come a little closer to a proof. This salutary mental exercise is not at all what F. Scott Fitzgerald was talking about, by the way. His endorsement of holding contradictory beliefs comes from The Crack-Up, his 1936 essay about his own irreparable brokenness. The opposing ideas he has in mind there are the sense of futility of effort and the sense of the necessity to struggle. Samuel Beckett later put it more succinctly, "I can't go on, I'll go on." Fitzgerald's characterization of a first-rate intelligence is meant to deny his own intelligence that designation. As he saw it, the pressure of the contradiction had made him effectively cease to exist, like Frege's set theory or a computer downed by Kirkian paradox. The House Martins, elsewhere in Sitting on a Fence, more or less summarized the crack-up. I lied to myself right from the start, and I just worked out that I'm falling apart. Unmanned and undone by self-doubt, drowned in books and introspection, he had become exactly the kind of sad young literary man who made Theodore Roosevelt puke. David Foster Wallace was interested in paradox, too. In his characteristically mathematical style, he put a somewhat tamed version of Russell's paradox at the center of his first novel, The Broom of the System. It isn't too strong to say his writing was driven by his struggle with contradictions. He was in love with the technical and analytic, but he saw that the simple dicta of religion and self-help offered better weapons against drugs, despair, and killing solipsism. He knew it was supposed to be the writer's job to get inside other people's heads, but his chief subject was the predicament of being stuck fast inside one's own. Determined to record and neutralize the influence of his own preoccupations and prejudices, he knew this determination was itself among those preoccupations and subject to those prejudices. This is Phil 101 stuff, to be sure, but as any math student knows, the old problems you meet freshman year are some of the deepest you ever see. Wallace wrestled with the paradoxes just the way mathematicians do. You believe two things that seem in opposition, and so you go to work, step by step, clearing the brush, separating what you know from what you believe, holding the opposing hypotheses side by side in your mind and viewing each in the adversarial light of the other until the truth, or the nearest you can get to it, comes clear. As for Beckett, he had a richer and more sympathetic view of contradiction, which is so ever-present in his work that it takes on every possible emotional color somewhere or other in the corpus. "I can't go on, I'll go on" is bleak, but Beckett also draws on the Pythagorean's proof of the irrationality of the square root of 2, turning it into a joke between drunks. "But betray me," said Neary, "and you go the way of Hippasos." "The acousmatic, I presume," said Wiley. "His retribution slips my mind." "Drowned in a puddle," said Neary, "for having divulged the incommensurability of side and diagonal." "So perish all babblers," said Wiley. It's not clear how much higher math Beckett knew, but in his late prose piece, Worstward Ho, he sums up the value of failure in mathematical creation more succinctly than any professor ever has. "Ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail again, fail better. When am I going to use this? The mathematicians we've encountered in this book are not just puncturers of unjustified certainties, not just critics who count. They found things and they built things. Galton uncovered the idea of regression to the mean. Condorcet built a new paradigm for social decision-making. Boyer created an entirely novel geometry, a strange new universe. Shannon and Hamming made a geometry of their own, a space where digital signals lived instead of circles and triangles. Wald got the armor on the right part of the plane. Every mathematician creates new things, some big, some small. All mathematical writing is creative writing. And the entities we can create mathematically are subject to no physical limits. They can be finite or infinite. They can be realizable in our observable universe or not. This sometimes leads outsiders to think of mathematicians as voyagers in a psychedelic realm of dangerous mental fire, staring straight at visions that would drive lesser beings mad, sometimes, indeed, being driven mad themselves. It's not like that, as we've seen. Mathematicians aren't crazy, and we aren't aliens, and we aren't mystics. But what's true is that the sensation of mathematical understanding, of suddenly knowing what's going on with total certainty all the way to the bottom, is a special thing, attainable in few, if any, other places in life. You feel you've reached into the universe's guts and put your hand on the wire. It's hard to describe to people who haven't experienced it. We are not free to say whatever we like about the wild entities we make up. They require definition, and having been defined, they are no more psychedelic than trees and fish. They are what they are. To do mathematics is to be, at once, touched by fire and bound by reason. This is no contradiction. Logic forms a narrow channel through which intuition flows with vastly augmented force. The lessons of mathematics are simple ones, and there are no numbers in them. That there is structure in the world, that we can hope to understand some of it and not just gape at what our senses present to us. That our intuition is stronger with a formal exoskeleton than without one. And that mathematical certainty is one thing, the softer convictions we find attached to us in everyday life another, and we should keep track of the difference if we can. Every time you observe that more of a good thing is not always better, or you remember that improbable things happen a lot given enough chances and resist the lure of the Baltimore stockbroker, or you make a decision based not just on the most likely future, but on the cloud of all possible futures, with attention to which ones are likely and which ones are not, or you let go of the idea that the beliefs of groups should be subject to the same rules as beliefs of individuals, or simply you find that cognitive sweet spot where you can let your intuition run wild on the network of tracks formal reasoning makes for it. Without writing down an equation or drawing a graph, you are doing mathematics, the extension of common sense by other means. When are you going to use it? You've been using mathematics since you were born, and you'll probably never stop. Use it well. This is Jordan Ellenberg. We hope that you've enjoyed this unabridged production of How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking. This program was produced and directed by Scott Cresswell. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. How Not to Be Wrong is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA LLC, a Penguin Random House company. Copyright 2014. Text copyright 2014 by Jordan Ellenberg. All rights reserved. Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.